Well, first of all, a couple of quick items of business here. Just in the next few weeks, here's what I'm looking at. We're not going to be meeting next week of Thanksgiving week. I have a number of people that are going out of town, so it makes sense. Let's just take next week off. We'll make sure we need to get that word around that we're not meeting next Monday. And this will actually be the last class of church history. Because we're kind of reaching a point here. We've covered a lot of things. So what I want to do is we'll finish up with church history today. It's only taken us, a year and a half?
Yeah.
Almost 2 years to get here. And then after we come back from the Thanksgiving break, we'll have two more classes in December. And we're making a turn into New Testament at that point. So that will be kind of fun. And that'll give us a chance to kind of set this up, give us a chance to have kind of a Christmas lesson in New Testament. And then we'll take a break for about 4 weeks through the Christmas holidays, first week or so of January, and then we'll start in the middle of January. We'll come back. So we good there? Okay. All right. So take a break next week. Have fun with Thanksgiving. The other thing is that we talked about the possibility of doing the church essays today. I started going down to the church essays, and I'm like, dang, we talked about all these. Anything that may be kind of, I don't know, a little off the beaten path, we've just dived right in, and we've just handled these things. So we're not doing church essays today. I thought I would, and I read through a bunch of them, and they're great, they're wonderful, and I highly recommend that to you. I wanted, since this was going to be the last class on church history, I wanted to kind of put a button on church history about where we are now. So, by the way, I thought this was good. I don't know if this is a meeting you'd like to go to. This is 1945. Professor and Mrs. Tolkien invite the pleasure of your company to celebrate the coming of age of their son, Chris Tolkien, who's in the Navy in 1945. Now, look at this. 6:30 onwards. That's when we're going. RSVP if you're not coming. And then he says, okay, carriages at midnight. Ambulances at 2 a.m. Wheelbarrows at 5 a.m. And hearses at daybreak. That's going to be a party to meet all parties. Right? If we're going to finish here with hearses at daybreak at the Tolkien's, I think that's one I would definitely want to be in on.
Is that the J.R. Tolkien?
That's Lord of the Rings guy, yeah. That was terrific. All right. And by the way, his son Chris is the one that would continue on making sure everything got published down the road. All right. And then I like this one, by the way. We're talking about doubt questions and stuff. Oh, my gosh. When I found out that popcorn doesn't come from apricot trees. that kind of shakes your testimony, doesn't it? Oh, man. But when you are 6 years old and you're sitting in primary and you're thinking about popcorn on apricot trees, and we had all of the little things, what a great surprise, I can hold it. It was awesome. Okay. All right. So I want to, kind of moving forward into kind of wrapping up church history. I think it's interesting that we were talking about what's happened during World War I and B.H. Roberts and everything that was going on. Right at the end of World War I, at the end of the Spanish flu, Heber J. Grant decided that we needed to know how the churches were doing worldwide. We've kind of been separated from them. We haven't been able to travel much. We've been holding off on missionaries. It's a little bit like what happened after World War II. What's going on with the church inside Germany and France and everything, the little branches, and so you got to go in and find out what's going on You remember that President Benson is talking about that he's finding in Germany that they were doing the sacrament with potato peels because that's all they got. And then they go into France and they find out that girls are passing the sacrament and blessing the sacrament. And they're just kind of adapting on their own. And by the way, if you haven't seen the movie yet on Truth and Treason, you really, really, really should. I think it's, is it still in the theaters here? About the LDS kid that's handing out pamphlets against
Helmut
the Nazis.
Helmut Hubert.
Okay. Yeah, and
Huber.
Helmut Huber. And how he was, he wasn't excommunicated, but he really, he sort of was officially, so the Nazis wouldn't worry about what he was doing. And then he is excommunicated. He then killed. But that movie is pretty good. But anyway, so we get to this point then, 1920. Church comes in to David O. McKay, who is the president of. He's the head. He's an apostle, but he's also head of church education. So they want him to go worldwide and examine all the branches out there, how they're doing, okay, worldwide. And so this is a little around the world trip he's going to take. It's going to take him a year.
This is
a steamship. Think of all how transportation would look like in 1920 if you're going to go all the way around the world, which he then does. Okay, so he's going to depart from North America. And begin their journey in Salt Lake, traveling to the west coast and across Pacific Ocean. And I think they leave from Seattle or Portland. Their first stop is Hawaii, and then they go Samoa, Tonga, Fiji, Tahiti, New Zealand, and Australia. Okay? Then he's going to get to Asia. He will go Japan, Korea, China, and India. Then he'll go to the Middle East. He does Egypt, Palestine, and Armenia. And again, think 1920.
We have churches in all of these?
We have little branches. In some cases, like in Palestine, they didn't yet have it, but they were just, in some cases they were just strangers, but in some cases they found like a little group or a little branch or something like that. Okay? Then he's going to go through Europe, and he's going to do all of the major European metropolises. Yeah, so you can all go through all of them. There he's obviously in 1920. He's meeting with a lot more branches and wards in Rome and London and Paris and stuff like that. Okay. Then he's going to return and they cross the Atlantic Ocean back to North America, arriving in Salt Lake City on Christmas Eve, 1921. That's a heck of a trip. Okay, now, in doing a little research, the story I remember him writing about one of his experiences on here, and then I found some additional stuff, just made me laugh. So this may be, remember a few weeks ago, we were talking about Lot Smith, and it's like, this may be my all-time favorite story from church history, his writing of that. This is probably better. So this is David O. McKay's journal. On his first leg, as they're leaving America and they're beginning to sail, and he says this, the pitching of the vessel in the night awoke me, and every nerve and muscle in my body responded to the movement of the boat. As this movement became more pronounced and intense, the contents of my digestive organs moved in unison with nerves and muscles. 21 years ago, one morning on the Atlantic, I had experienced a similar feeling, so I knew I'd better dress carefully and get on deck. At that moment, Brother Cannon jumped out of bed as bright and pert as a 10-year-old boy. Brother Cannon is he's the editor for the Improvement Era, and he also works for the Deseret News. Okay.
Is that George Q. Cannon?
This is his son.
It's his son.
Hugh Cannon. Okay. Now, by the way, I get this feeling in the cruises and things that we've done, I've never gotten seasick except for once. And it was on steak and lobster night. So bad. Okay. So I'm sympathetic with this because I've only done it once. And I had an inner ear cold. So it was, anyway. So, all right. It was a dismal sounding gong that called us to breakfast, however, a fitting accompaniment to the gloom of the weather. However, before attempting to dress, I ate an apple, which Hugh J. handed me. Without hurry, I put on my clothes and started for the deck. But the swaying staircase and the madly moving world of water stirred my feelings with a desire for solitude. Yielding, but wait, there's more, right? Yielding, I hurried to my room, where in less time it takes to tell you, the apple and I parted company forever. I wondered what there was in common between a Jonathan Apple and a Jonah that would produce such like effects. Though I arrived at no definite conclusion, one thing was most certain, my sympathy was wholly with the whale. I understood, too, how Jonah escaped by being thrown into the sea. If I could have entirely followed the whale's example, I, too, would have swum for land. Hugh J. returned from breakfast looking as robust and rosy as an athlete. Limp and dejected, I looked at him, healthy and happy, and began right then and there to doubt the wisdom of the revolutionary statesman who declared all men are created equal. Okay? Feeling somewhat better, I started for the deck and was not a little consoled when I passed a poor Chinaman with perspiration standing in beads on his jaundiced looking face and sitting holding his knees, looking, as I'm sure he felt, the most forsaken, limpy lump of humanity in existence. At any rate, I had company in furnishing amusement for the chosen few. Everybody's laughing at it, okay? Then he says, this time I reached only the top of the stairs, when that intense yearning to be alone drove me back to my cabin. Good night, last night's dinner. Goodbye, yesterday's luncheon. And during the next 60 hours, goodbye everything I had ever eaten since I was a babe on mother's knee. I'm not sure I didn't cross the threshold into the pre-existent state. That's so great. So I've known about this story for a long time, and I've loved it for a long time. However, it was just this week that I found Hugh J's response to this event. And he's pretty good. So watching President McKay, Elder McKay, he says this. Elder David O. McKay would have joined me in writing this letter, but other things came up. Then he says, to tell just what came up, it would be necessary to look over the menu cards furnished at the various socials and banquets given in his honor before leaving home, as well as those placed before us on this trip. And these cards, like that which came up, have not been preserved.
Do you know, was his wife traveling with him?
No, it was just these two. Emma was smarter than that. Brother McKay does nothing by halves. He doesn't do things halfway. Well, then he says, he treats every subject exhaustively, going to the very bottom of it. And this occasion was no exception. Seasickness is undertaken with the same vigorous energy which is displayed when he leaves a meeting in the church office building with only 2 minutes to catch a train. In neither case is it safe to get in his way. I just think of these guys sitting there writing up the experience and then almost trying to outdo each other. It's just pretty great stuff. Anyway, give you an idea of President McKay's humor. By the way, I did, growing up in Layton, in Utah, I would occasionally talk to police who had the experience Highway 89 comes out of Salt Lake, it passes through Layton and Kaysville on its way to Ogden and Ogden to Huntsville.
Catch the prophet speeding?
Yes, yes. True stories of the car speeding down there going about 70 or 80 miles an hour down 89. Older man, white hair flowing, they'd pull him over and they'd say, "It's President McKay," and they just ask him to slow down and he would just take off again. So he would just, President McKay. And I have one other memory of President McKay, and that is that in 1963, I think, President Kennedy came to speak and he spoke in the tabernacle. And so my dad was kind of excited about actually getting to see the president. So we actually went down to just outside Temple Square and stood in the crowds outside. And he hoisted me up on his shoulders. I'm about, what, seven, I think, at that point, 6 or 7. And put me on his shoulders. And as I looked over there, I saw President McKay and President Kennedy drive by. So, you impressed?
I'm impressed you can remember that.
Yeah, I am too. It's just a flash, that's all I've got. Yeah.
Well, thinking of the technology at the time, the cruise ships that we're on now, they have stabilizers and everything. My mother's, my grandmother was a World War I bride from England. And so in 1932 or 33, my mom and the family went back to visit family in England, and they went, they could barely afford it, so they went steerage class, and it was not, movement, seasickness was a much bigger problem back then.
Oh man, when one of the first trips that we did with Bountiful Travel, they placed us in what would be steerage. We were on the very bottom of the ship to the front of the ship, way down in the depths of that thing, and all night Cindy and I thought the ship would had crashed because it would be breaking through the waves. We get this and the whole room would just shake, that front. And so the next time we did a trip, I said, okay, we're staying in a balcony. I will pay extra to make sure we're in the balcony, not in the bowels of the ship. Yeah.
Is that when you got sick?
No, it actually wasn't. I was in a good place. It's just the cold messed me up.
You mentioned John F. Kennedy speaking in Utah.
Yeah, the tabernacle.
And I remember my father commenting on that apparently while he was speaking, he said, when Joseph Smith saw God and Jesus in his vision, and he said, there's no way he believes that. And my father criticized him for saying that. But yeah, he's a politician, right?
He was actually pretty kind in general. I don't remember we didn't go in for the speech, and I wouldn't have remembered it anyway.
So as we look back, you know, things have changed so much. I was in the mission home that with the three old houses behind the church office building.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And my window looked out at the back of the church office building, and I was looking out. President McKay drove in his Cadillac. He got out of the car by himself and walked around into the church office building. And, you know, we would be surrounded by security today. He would never be out driving
no.
the car. And it was a very simple time.
It was.
Comparison.
So I love, you know, when we've been talking about Joseph Fielding Smith and President McKay, it's just amazing that we could have actually had a chance to visit with some of these people. And they could have, amazing the things they could have told us back then. But anyway, all right. So let's jump way ahead here. This is what just happened in August. This is 120 baptized at once in Sierra Leone in Africa. Okay? Like I say, just happened, and we're seeing some incredible numbers. In fact, I was just listening. The church just created 55 new missions, including
Dallas
North. Right? We're waiting to see exactly. Do we know yet where the lines are?
55 are in Texas.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So it's huge, but seven new ones in Africa. Okay. So it's blown up.
And there's 34 countries in the world right now where becoming a Christian will get you killed.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more missionary work that can happen when people aren't feeling like they're gonna, aren't reasonably feeling like they're gonna get killed if they leave their existing faith.
Well, here's the deal with this. A little side note on this. So, there's some pictures from this. They have this many people that are going to all get baptized at once. A unique challenge for this moment was the clothing. With 120 people expected, there were not nearly enough white baptismal outfits. Cindy used to do all of the washing of the baptismal stuff in the Plano State. And just trying to get those things back from the missionaries after they had done one so that we'd be ready for the next Saturday was always a challenge.
And finding white clothing that doesn't turn invisible when it's wet?
Yes, exactly. So senior missionaries located 210 yards of white cotton fabric in the Bow Marketplace, and then they sent it to Mariba Town with it. Senior missionaries, Brother and Sister Hansen from Leeds, worked with local tailors to sew a dozen of baptismal clothes using pedal-powered machines. One tailor was hired to help meet the deadline. Elder Hansen saw him leave later carrying home a 110-pound sack of rice, his family's food for the month, likely paid for by the baptismal clothing worker.
Wow. That's pretty cheap work.
Yeah. But again, we're going back to that talk in General Conference where they're talking about people coming to church and passing all of the vendors that are buying food for the night based on the work that they did during the day. Because it's that close. So if you take kind of where the church is growing and the expansion and all of that, look at what's happening here. So this is a little bit dated. The following statistics are most recently publicly available data. Currently as late as 2024 and into mid-2025, was a year old. Missions. The total number reached 54 in Africa after 9 new missions were added in Africa in July alone. And then again, we've added another 7, I think, this year, including those in the DRC, Ghana, Kenya, Madagascar, Nigeria, and Sierra Leone. Stakes. While there's not a single aggregate number for all of Africa, data from mid-2025 shows 5 African countries, Nigeria, DR Congo, are among the top 30 countries worldwide with the most stakes, accounting for over 200 stakes among them. The total for the continent is higher. Membership. Nigeria alone has the largest LDS members in Africa with over 250,000 members as of 2024. Yeah, you got some.
I may have mentioned this before, but when we left the DRC in 2022, they were projecting that they would be baptizing a stake a month.
Wow.
For the coming year. It's amazing. And the missionaries in DRC are either from Africa. There are no white missionaries there. They come from other countries in Africa, but most of them are from the DRC itself.
They're just taking care of their own.
Yeah.
Wow.
One of the big challenges is their standard of living when they come on to a mission is so much higher than what they left that they really have a challenge as they reintegrate back into home life. It's is a big, big challenge.
Well, and isn't that part of what was driving to the, with BYU Idaho and trying to do outreach with them so that we can start to get them getting degrees and getting education?
So Nigeria is on the list. And Nigeria is the sixth most dangerous country in the world for Christians. And they say here that one Christian is murdered every 2 hours for converting away from Islam.
So how does the church work there?
I don't know.
Some of those are kind of on the outskirts out there. I mean, the closer I think you get into the city.
And Nigeria is a huge country, though.
Kind of more exciting to me, though, I love all this, I think it's wonderful, but I'm really looking forward to the day when we do have an apostle that's from Africa. And, you know, kind of the pattern mm-hmm. that they've been doing over the last 20 or 30 years has been, it's either somebody pulled up from the presidency of the 70 or from the presiding bishopric, which Elder Kosse was from, but Elder Edward Dubay is actually from Zimbabwe. He was just, he's in the presidency of the 70 now, but he's only been in about a year, so he's kind of newer. But I just love the idea of seeing some of these saints being put in leadership.
Oh, for sure.
We need their worldview. You know?
Yeah, we do need their worldview. Okay, so let me step backward. And we talked about some of this when we talked about the lifting of the priesthood ban. But I wanted to get a chance to kind of jump a little bit farther in, because I think it sets us up for where I think we want to go. That's where I want to finish up today, is where are we going? So if we're going back, to the 50s and 60s, this is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Inc. And nobody going to this church had been baptized. This is the 1950s.
Right. Where is it?
I think this was in Nigeria. 30 years before the revelation, church leaders became aware of black Africans who were interested in the church. By the 1950s, many letters were sent to the church headquarters from West African nations, primarily Nigeria and Ghana, requesting literature and membership in the church. The letters were written by devout Christians who had gained a testimony from the Book of Mormon or other church literature, okay? And we'll talk a little bit about Billy Johnson in just a sec. Did you ever get a chance to run across Billy? I guess Billy Johnson been dead by then. What began as a comparative trickle of requests in the early 1950s became a flood by the 1960s. More letters requesting church literature were received from Nigeria and Ghana than all the rest of the world combined. The church responded by sending literature, but the demand was so great that some Africans even established LDS bookstores. Remember, none of these guys are baptized. However, since there were no priesthood holders to preside and provide priesthood ordinances, those asking for baptism were told, "The time is not yet. You must wait." Whether or not showing a might have been in this chapel, but I've been at classes where they actually have brought from the church museum the carved angel Moroni, it's about a 7-foot statue that would sit in the front of the chapel, a replica of the temple angel Moroni. But they had carved it and painted it with gold, and then they put it at the front of the chapel. You know, if you're going to have, you know, if you come from a Christian church that might have a crucifix or something like that, they figured they needed to have that. We're just guessing. So one biographer noted in 1960, as they waited, they shared their knowledge and testimony of the gospel with others and organized congregations. It was reported that in the 1960s, there were over 60 congregations in Nigeria and Ghana with more than 16,000 participants, none of whom were baptized. This was a paradox for the church. Here's the problem. With an army of missionaries eager to go to the ends of the earth to teach and baptize, there were thousands in Africa pleading to join the church whom we weren't able to baptize. As far as is known, nothing like this has occurred in this or any other dispensation. Where you have that many people that really want to join the church that can't. Okay? So how does this work? Well, so again, in 1961, then, President McKay, with this knowledge and understanding, assigns Lamar Williams, secretary of the church department, because he's been the one that's been communicating back and forth with all of these LDS pastors, of which there are at least 10. At least that day. To go to Nigeria on a month-long fact-finding mission to determine if the people were sincere and willing to accept the church without holding the priesthood. Though Brother Williams had been responding to the flood of letters, he was not prepared by what he found. He was met at the airport in Port Harcourt, Nigeria, by 10 pastors with whom he'd been corresponding. He was treated like royalty, but surprised to discover that not only did they operate independently, they were not even aware of each other. They didn't even know each other. They were all doing this on their own. Okay? Crazy? The first official church meeting in Black Africa was held October 22nd, 1961, in a small mud hut in Opobo, where Brother Williams met with a pastor and 110 followers. No one came by car. Many, including 8 mothers with small children, had begun their day before 4 a.m. and walked 25 miles or more to be there. After teaching them for 2 hours, Brother Williams was prepared to end the meeting. Okay? This is what he recorded. It was hot as blazes. My suit was wringing wet. When I turned the meeting back to the pastor, I heard a murmur go through the congregation, and the pastor said to me, they don't want to go home. They have something to say. Then for another 3 hours, these people were standing to bear testimony to the truthfulness of the church and how they believed in the prophets. I could not believe what I was hearing. One elderly gentleman said, I keep hearing you say, if we are sincere. Elder Williams, I want you to know that I am sincere. I'm an old man. I'm sick. But when I heard you were going to be here, I walked 16 miles this morning to see you and to hear what you have to say. I still have to walk 16 miles to get back home, and I am not well. I want you to know that I am sincere, or I would not be here. I have not seen President McKay. I have not seen God. But I have seen you. And I will hold you personally accountable to tell President McKay that I am sincere. I don't know how you resonate with that, you know? To have that conviction coming from those people who have been wanting and craving this so much. Right. So he then goes back to Salt Lake and he says, these guys are on. And he's telling everything that he's seen and hearing. And remember, it's in this stretch, I didn't include it, that part of the correspondence that he's getting from Africa is reading. They open it up. And the letterhead says, Ghana Akria branch of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And President McKay says, I didn't know we had a branch there. they've got a letterhead. You know, we don't have a branch there. No, I know, but they are seeing themselves as a branch of the church, and they're acting accordingly. And all they've really got is copies of the Book of Mormon that they're passing around and what other little leaflets they can find.
Probably not in their language.
And probably not in their language. Yeah?
Kevin, how did this start? I mean, they wouldn't have the internet or any of that. I mean,
Hold on, we'll get there.
Well, I was just going to say, at least in the DRC, and I think in Ghana, it was people in Europe. I know in DRC it was a person that was really converted in France, and then came back to Africa.
Yeah, because it's happening, there's a variety of reasons.
Well, wasn't there a guy that lived in South Africa that would come up and do ordinance work, I mean, do just come up and kind of get them organized a little bit, and what's his name?
A little bit, hold on, you're gonna, we'll talk about
this. This is later.
Yeah, that's later, yeah. Okay. So what's gonna happen is that the church is gonna start sending more and more literature, they believe they're sincere, and they're talking about how they could begin, what are they gonna do about missionaries, and they're in the middle of all of this. Which is really interesting, because this is all also coming as the civil rights movement is picking up steam in the United States, okay? Getting more and more and more here, okay? So what happens is that for the next 4 years, the church made every effort to send missionaries, but the Nigerian government refused to issue the necessary visas. And part of the problem was is that there was a coming war in Nigeria. And this they call the freeze. So they're all set to do this, and then the war comes, and it will create the freeze. When Africa's most devastating civil war, the Biafran War, exploded in Nigeria, these efforts ceased. So Mar Williams turned over 15,000 names of unbaptized African converts to Elder Spencer W. Kimball and Gordon B. Hinckley, both of who were on the Church Missionary Committee, as he's retired. Okay? But right now things are under freeze, and so we're going to roll into the 1970s with basically the freeze still on, and it hasn't yet opened up.
So, by the way, Kevin, I think that's Biafran.
Yeah.
Biafra wasn't it an actual place?
Yeah, it was. Thank you. Okay. The church made every effort to establish itself in West Africa, but was prevented from doing so. However, the Lord has promised that his eternal blessings will come in his own time, in his own way, and according to his own will. And by the way, just this last week, I had a chance to talk briefly with Mark Romney, who is now doing, he's the legal, the church's legal representative, and he's got over a third of Africa that he's responsible for, and they are in the DRC. And there are a number of countries where we have no presence at all, but what his job is to help pave the way for us to get visas and to establish the church in some of these places. So this is a battle that's still going on.
Okay. Kevin, even while we were there, one of the things that we were working on as communication missionaries for the area, Africa Central area, was getting official recognition.
Yeah.
The church is often recognized as one of the NGOs. And that's how they get officially recognized, but they are not recognized as a religious organization.
So it's our humanitarian efforts that are leading the way, and that makes sense.
So there was a legion of lawyers in Nairobi that would come to Kinshasa every...
That's where Mark is in Kinshasa.
Yeah, and that's where we were now. So
yeah,
it's a real challenge.
They're telling me that they went outside the compound and went driving, and they made eye contact with a policeman.
Oh, I could tell you a story.
That's good. They ended up down a wrong road with this policeman, and it cost them about, what, $40 to bribe this guy and get out of there.
Well, we had real problems. We stopped driving. We would stay within the 6-block area of our compound, but anybody can put on a police uniform. Anyway, we had a really bad experience where the policeman actually ripped the license plate off of our car. And thankfully, the adult son of one of the Congolese mission presidents was walking by, and he came over and asked what was going on, and he went and negotiated with the policeman. Cost us $30 to get our license plate back, but It's a dangerous place. It really is.
That's what they're saying. Okay. All right, so you get a chance. I mean, it's just we're heading into this area, and actually the U.S. might end up going to war in Africa pretty quick. They were trying to stop the killing of Christians.
Hello.
Okay, so how does it start? There's a variety of voices that step up at this time that lead us towards having the church in Africa. One is Billy Johnson, what I call the African Paul. And he may have had more converts than Paul did, if you look at it in the whole aggregate. Billy Johnson is in Ghana. The field is ready to harvest, mainly due to another Elias, Joseph William Billy Johnson. He obtains a copy of the Book of Mormon in 1964 from another man, and he says, "As I read the Book of Mormon, I became convinced that it really was the Word of God, and sometimes when reading it, I would burst into tears. I felt the Spirit as I read. I have a strong testimony of the Book of Mormon. It's a powerful book." Brother Johnson knew that the Lord had called him to be an Elias. He says, "Early one morning, I saw the heavens open." That's why I think of him as Paul. "And angels with trumpets singing songs of praise unto God. In the course of this, I heard my name mentioned thrice. Johnson, Johnson, Johnson. If you will take up my work as I will command you, I will bless you and bless your land." Trembling and in tears, I replied, "Lord, with thy help, I will do whatsoever you will command me." From that day onward, I was constrained by that Spirit to go from street to street to deliver the message which we had read from the Book of Mormon. I did exactly as the Lord commanded me, and immediately our persecution started. There's another man that's helping him along. He will ultimately go back to South Africa, and it will be Billy Johnson, but he will then begin organizing branches in Ghana.
So when you say South Africa, you don't mean the country, you mean the
his friend went
geographic
back to South,
area?
No, his friend went back to South Africa.
Okay.
So Billy was in, so he was in Ghana, he organizes it, he then goes to another country. I don't remember all the places that he goes. But he's full-time doing this. This is his passion, this is his love, and he's setting up congregations and ordaining pastors as he goes. Okay? So, here comes his letter to President McKay. "I have to say that my heart will not rest until I achieve my objective to be a baptized member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to receive the gift of the Holy Ghost, which he does not yet have."
So is he the one ordaining people?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the only way that they know how. "And to be fully instructed in the gospel is restored to the prophet Joseph Smith in order to be able to preach the true gospel to my people and win for my Savior hearts that should otherwise perish in the darkness." Is that amazing? So, we get past the freeze, and finally in 1978, we talked a few weeks ago about everything that President Kimball went to finally get everybody on board, have a spiritual revelation that this is what's supposed to happen. And so we get this little vignette here. "One tender moment of rejoicing was shared by David M. Kennedy, who at that time was kind of the church's ambassador," this is in the 70s, "who had served for years as President Kimball's special ambassador to helping the church enter new countries. Previous to the revelation, as they would study a large map of the world, Brother Kennedy would place one hand over the continent of Africa, saying, 'We can't go there until they have the priesthood. How do we organize anything? We can't go there until they have the priesthood.' On July 9th, 1978, a subdued President Kimball returned from the temple prior to announcing to the world the revelation that had been received. He stopped at Brother Kennedy's office, opened the door, and with deep emotion, he said, 'David, you can take your hand off of Africa.'" All right. So, all this, and I thought I'd just kind of open this up for a little bit of a discussion here. Because for God so loved the world, the question is, with the knowledge of our rich history and everything we've studied, what are we being called to do now? As Boyd K. Packer used to say, therefore what? Now that we know what's going on. Let me make a suggestion. Okay. This is the stages of the faith stages that we have talked about a few times over the last couple of years. But I want to put it in a little bit different context. You remember that we start with an idea that so often in the church we begin with simplicity, very simple faith, it's an all or nothing kind of thing. There's us and there's them. Then oftentimes we then move to complexity. And complexity is that process of building on our simplicity. Now, over here, we really don't know about what those guys are doing over there in that other group. In complexity, we start to understand enough about other people just so that we can capture and convert. You know, understand enough about Baptists to speak their language, throw scriptures back at them, and then hopefully baptize them. Okay? However, later in complexity, what happens is we gain more knowledge and more understanding. We start to find truth and understanding in other groups and other situations. And this is where holy envy starts to show up. We were at a synagogue on Thursday night listening to a military tribute to Jewish veterans in synagogue near downtown. And they sound very much like us. And I'm trying to live my military stuff. They won't let me worship on Yom Kippur. We have to go out as a small group of us out on the edge of the aircraft carrier to worship on Shabbat, you know, and we're being misunderstood and we're being mistreated and there's anti-Semitism. I mean, and it sounds very much like we understand the persecution that comes by people that don't understand. Okay? Great experience. Okay? But sometimes then in later complexity, for some people that start to understand all that, then they start getting confused because maybe our church history hasn't been told well, or we get surprised by things, and so there are obviously a lot of people in the church that have now gone from complexity and understanding to getting pulled into perplexity, and now this is where we just drop the church. We may not even believe in God. We don't believe anything that anybody's going to tell us. Everything is, I've been lied to, I've been betrayed, or I have to leave my community and I'm hurt and lost, or now I'm happier than I ever have been because I don't have this stuff. But that's perplexity. Some people will go there. I think for most people, however, hopefully we end up in a state of harmony where we don't have to give up our faith and our understanding of the gospel to interact with other people. When we go into like a synagogue, it's not a challenge to my LDS faith. It is, I'm learning things from them that I hadn't maybe thought of. It's a blessing to me, and I'm looking for places of harmony. And we stood out in the parking lot and talked to one of the friends that invited us there, and we talked about how the things we have similar between us and Orthodox Jews. Okay, and that's that kind of harmonization that I think we can get into when we start to connect with other people. Okay. Now, sometimes they don't want to connect with us. It's okay.
Their loss, right?
It's their loss, yes.
So I think part of the reason whether we think they want to connect with us, sometimes we can look at someone who has another faith and other beliefs, and we can just feel good about the fact that they honor what they believe.
Yeah.
And we don't feel the need to correct them. And other times, we feel good about them honoring what they believe, but we see an opportunity to give them additional light that they embrace.
Absolutely.
And but there's those of us, or those moments in our own lives where we see somebody and we give them additional light that they don't embrace, and we want to pound it into their head.
I think if we're in simplicity or early complexity, the only interaction we have with people of other faith is to soften them up so that we can call them missionaries.
I think when we recognize that we have absolutely no responsibility to convert anybody, that our responsibility is to provide them the best environment where they can grow.
Yeah.
And leave it with them to where
let
they're
the
headed.
Holy Ghost do its thing. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I got here a little late, but why hasn't it been as effective with the American blacks?
With American what?
Blacks.
I think that's a good question. So that's why, you know, he's wondering why is it, in terms of traditional black churches, and it's funny, our outreach, if we're leading with missionary work, there's still a lot of prejudice about what they've heard, what they've been told. Again, just go to Google and put in Mormons and African Americans and see how well that goes. You know, there is that. But to have President Nelson speak at the NAACP, to have us annually in the Plano State help the local NAACP chapter in terms of setting up the Freedom School for their kids, and we're meeting. We're deciding, actually starting on Thursday this week, we're looking at what that will look like for next year. How do we involve them? What do we need to do? What services? We got a message just this week from a Muslim who is the Ahmadiyya faith, is a different sect. We're going to be providing basketball courts, like they've been doing in McKinney. We're going to be providing a basketball court in Plano for their youth to come and play basketball.
So the answer is we've got a lot of explaining to do.
Like, Lucy, we've got a lot of explaining to do here.
Right.
Yeah. Well, okay, so.
Just one more thing. I mean, we keep talking about the priesthood ban.
Yeah.
Would it be more accurate to call it more of a racial ban?
I think it should have been like I think we should call it the priesthood restoration.
Right.
Because we restored to what Joseph was already doing.
I mean, even black sisters were unable to go into the temple.
For sure. Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the priesthood.
I'm right on board with you. I'm right on board with you.
I really prefer priesthood and temple ban because priesthood is very male-centric.
Yes.
Women were denied the opportunity to go to the temple throughout all this.
That's right.
And it's sort of a little bit dismissive of their...
So almost a temple ban might just be more inclusive. I like that.
Seems to me that when you're in harmony, which I like to think I am, and I may have gone through all this, I don't know, but it seems to me we are not threatened by them.
Mm-hmm.
But people who of other faiths who are in simplicity are threatened.
They are threatened.
Believe me, I know it. I have heard from my family.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we wonder why. I think that's it. They're threatened by us. And I think about this African thing, things I'm hearing from Don and from other people about what it must be like there. The choice is between, there's a choice between good or evil. And here, in our country, there's a lot of gray. You can still be belong to a Christian church and not be a member of ours. You don't have to worry about your safety and all this kind of thing. But to me, why wouldn't you join the church?
Well, and that, okay, hold on to that idea. Okay? All right, so here's what I did. I looked at, this is the stages we're talking about. Mm-hmm. I need you to see, I guess, that while we go through this individually in our own lives, if you look at everything we've studied for the last year and a half in the church, the church has also gone through the stages. So take this same template and put it over our church history and see what we come up with. Okay? So, did we go through a period of time where if you're joining the church, the idea is to come out of the world, come safely inside the fortress, and be safe here because out there is not safe.
To be gathered.
be gathered in before the sheaves are burned. Yeah, that was the language. Okay, we got to get you in here because there's a burning coming, and to save your life, you've got to be back in, first of all, in Zion, or in the New Jerusalem. But then we get out to Utah, and now you got to get back inside the safety of the mountains. And it doesn't matter where you're growing up in the church, in England or wherever. Now, ultimately, your goal is to be inside the safety of the mountains. And I think sometimes there's still a feeling that exists among members of the church that says, boy, I'll tell you what, Plano's rough, you know, and our kids are having a hard time. If we could just get us to American Fork, if we'll get it to Salt Lake, things will be much better. Get inside, you know. Yeah?
I grew up near Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And the people there felt that. Oh, you know, Utah's a Zion. And one time one of the girls in our young women's group came back and goes, you know, I've been out there. They have just as many problems as we do.
Yeah.
That's not the thing you think it is.
Yeah. But how long did we hear this, where the church was very centric this way, of saying, there is us's and them's? Well, I was reading this. Well, is he an LDS author? Well, no. Well, then. Because, you know, and there is this feeling, and especially if you tend towards kind of simplicity, you might still kind of be a little bit more comfortable inside my world, and I'm not necessarily as comfortable in the world, because the world's the problem. We need you inside here. Okay? And I think the church has gone through decades of this. Now, one of the things that I think we found is that especially as we started to roll in, as Utah becomes a state, and now we're sending senators, like Senator Smoot, all the way up to having a presidential candidate who didn't lose by that much, who was Mormon. You know, there's this sense of, but we still need to have in the back of our head that our job is to convert the world. Again, it's still to convert so we can pull them inside the safety before the second coming happens. Okay? So our job is to go out and convert the world. And I think that was the original idea as they rolled into the 20s. We're sending out missionaries, they will baptize wherever, and then let's get you into Utah, into safety, and build up Zion. Okay. Now, over time, as people were staying where they were, as the church got stronger, now what's happening, we're having to engage more with the world. That's complexity. Do I know enough about other churches? Do I know enough about Philadelphia? You know, we're having to engage and understand what's going on with the world. And that's why I think it's interesting at the moment when I see BYU going out of its way to invite non-member scholars to come into BYU and study. Let's engage. Let's understand who we are. Hopefully now this process of engagement comes with a cost. There are going to be some, you know, with our kids, they might choose the world if we expose them too much, you know, and so there's sometimes, depending on where we are over here, that we still, how do we protect our families? Well, we're wanting to do this, aren't we?
So the model there, I mean, you, appears to me that you've included all the wonderful and all the horrible in the term the world.
That's right.
Okay.
And which is how we saw it. The world is horrible.
And so if we just go back to the concept that which is good comes from God, and that which teaches harm, you know, teaches yep. love and things like that yep. comes from God, we're not, I mean, I don't want to engage with the world. I want to engage with good people and with good concepts and like that. And I've never felt to convert the world, but rather to share the gospel with the world.
Yeah.
But this where you're going down to perplexity, I'm not interested in engaging with, contentious environments.
Well, perplexity is a question, though. Sometimes we say, I wonder what, then we can move to harmony. I mean, sometimes that we go through perplexity to get there.
So, sometimes we'll go this way.
Because if you don't have a question, there's not going to be an answer.
Right. And yet, isn't it interesting that ultimately, if what we're trying to get to is up here, then our question is, what's our responsibility? And we've never not lost the one to say it's important that we share the gospel. But at the same time, we're also having to say, what's his name? I'm blocking on his name. Anyway, the Eastern scholar that came to BYU, and he said, I'm here to tell you that Mormons are the answer. We need your voice because you guys in your geographical wards are working together and we're polarized. We need people to show us how to be peacemakers, and part of what drew him was President Nelson's dialogue about peacemakers are needed to solve the polarization that's going on.
And the fort is deteriorating. It's not safe. There is no fort almost.
No, there isn't. The internet.
We can think we're in one, but basically, we are in the world.
But if we're still kind of in this mindset, then we're trying to shut out all the world, and like you say, I think you'd go out there, and the world was language for all the bad stuff, the wrong stuff, the horrible stuff. But in this world, it just got converted to, that's not LDS. That's a non-LDS thinking, as opposed to out where God so loves the world, meaning the framing of the world is all those people that are out there with beautiful knowledge and understanding and their take on things, that love their families. We have things for them. Yeah, we got stuff.
I'm going to throw this out there. Elder Gupdorf, is he possibly the only apostle that was not, his family was new to the church?
We've got others.
Elder Keaton?
Karen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kieran. And then, do we know what Elder Classe is? Man, I want to call him Clouseau.
But my real point is, when I hear Elder Uchtdorf speak, he's different than people that have, been raised and their ancestors were pioneers and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think it's already been said, we can learn from that new perspective.
Well, so now we have a German, an Englishman, and a Frenchman. And then the next wave is going to probably be the African. But again, they're coming from a different area. But do you think that they are more comfortable engaging with the good people around the world? It's like listening to Sister Eubanks the other night, Sharon Eubanks, talking about how the church is leading the humanitarian effort, but they're working with all different groups, and they're finding good people everywhere. And we're a voice in that, and a leader. We should be. Yeah.
Well, the church right now is going through a transition. It is an American church that has gone international.
Yes. Yeah.
That does not make it an international church.
Yes.
The example is all of our material has to be remade. Part of what we were involved in was making
translating.
It's not just translating, because the films are all white people shot in Utah. And,
I know.
And
when their mouse
moves,
it's English.
That's why they don't have a mouse move anymore.
Yeah.
My sister lives in Lehi, and every year for the past 2 or 3 years, she has organized an interfaith Christmas concert concentrating on LGBTQ and other religions coming, giving the prayers, giving talks, giving singing things. And each year she's had to move the event to a bigger area because there are so many people that want to come to that.
A few years ago, Cindy and I went to the weekend after Thanksgiving. We went up to Nauvoo and spent the weekend up there. And it, as we pulled in, we realized they were having a Messiah sing-along that night, and the old church has now been torn down. So we sat in on the sing-along, okay, and it was wonderful. But it was interesting when you started taking a look. If you do the full sing-along, you're going to have the soloists, not just the main songs, right? So I looked at the soloists, and one soloist was from Warsaw, one was from Keokuk, one was from Carthage. They were from all over. None was from Quincy. And you had all of these different voices all blending on something like that. So I guess in where I'm going with this is, how do we do this? Maybe I just kind of finish with this. If we understand our history better, where we've come from, what worked, what didn't work, what we've been through, and now we're trying to get past what was in the early days. I kind of take this to a certain extent through maybe the 1980s, if I wanted to start. In some ways, we were kind of doing this. I think this has kind of been the 90s and early 2000s is one, and I might be wrong, but this is when I try to superimpose some things on there. This is what's coming, and I don't know what this looks like. But I think we have worked hard to get here. Yeah?
As a convert, I think we need to stop thinking we have to apologize for our history. Because I came from another religion and wonderful people, but they had their stuff too. And the whole country did. And some of these things that we talk about, racism and the way women were treated, it wasn't just the church.
No.
It was all over the United States. It was all over the world in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, the Lord has left us on our own, but we use his guides to sort these things out and to become a better people, all of us.
Right.
And so I don't think we need to apologize to anybody about something. What about this? What about that?
But we do that when we are inward facing. When we're in here, we're just looking at ourselves, we're protective and we feel persecuted, and we kind of stay in here, mm-hmm. versus if we get here, now we begin to be outward facing, and our job is to bless those around us.
Yeah, healing the world, to me, we're healing those that want to be healed. And when I read Revelation and stuff like that, I don't see that group as the world. I see that group as the minority. And so in my perspective, I'm looking for the church to grow rapidly while wickedness grows rapidly. And I'm not looking for the balance to ever lean in favor of righteousness until the end.
So for good people, though, faced with all of that, this is when they need us more than ever, even if they're never going to join the church. Yeah.
Well, one of the things we were talking about in seminary last week was plural marriage. And we said, you know, a lot of people point to us and say, oh, you're evil, you have plural marriage. If you're a Christian, what about Abraham?
Yeah.
They have the same as we do.
They have battles. But if we're more interested in how do we help bring peace, regardless of our histories, suddenly we've shifted the whole discussion. Yeah.
Well, this growth, I mean, we're always happy about the numbers in the church, but in the United States, we're still less than 2%. And as our growth
in
other parts of the world is, we still remain less than 1%.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, how can we be salt to the world, you know, or that?
But yet we're called to be.
Because thinking that we're going to become 80%.
It's not going to happen.
Not going to happen the next 25 years.
No, we're never going to be a large church. But is it interesting, anything that you're cooking, how much salt do you need to really kind of change the flavor?
That's what I was going to say. You don't use a lot of salt.
No, you don't.
Well, that's what they use that as always a...
But that's the thing that we use. But we're never going to be, and if it was always about the Savior coming until 80% of the world is Mormon, that's not happening. But if we are out doing good and doing the things that we can do, we become that that salt, and we can bring peace, stuff like that. So.
Well, he doesn't come as a result of our success. He comes to, at when it looks like the demise of all righteousness is.
Yeah, he can come back us up. Okay, Joe.
Back to marriage itself. The whole institution of marriage has really changed a lot. And I think in many ways our church, and you don't practice plural marriage anymore, but we are kinder to divorced women and divorced people than a lot of other religions are.
Yeah.
There was a time in this country, if you were divorced, you were, you know, kicked out of society and all that. When I got divorced for my first marriage in the 90s, is it the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
I have a very good friend in Illinois who belonged to a very large Protestant sect in Illinois. There's churches everywhere. And we met in Chicago and had a girls' weekend. And she kept asking me questions. She was divorced too. She kept asking me questions. What is your church doing to you? What's happening?
Mm.
And I think I had just been called to the Relief Society presidency. And I'm just saying, oh, nothing, you know, I'm going to go in the temple, you know. And finally she told me her story. She was kicked out of her church.
Oh, well.
Because she got divorced from a man who put her in the hospital for breaking her jaw. And I thought, boy, I said, it never occurred to me. I don't know of anybody in the church who gets treated like that. And so when they talk about plural marriage and all of that, there was a lot of stuff and still going on to all kinds of churches, and we really don't need to apologize for something that maybe didn't work or we don't
need
anymore.
Yeah, and maybe that's a good way to kind of put a button on this. But I think the key is that we have this history, but the history tells me that the gospel's true, that Jesus is Christ, but it also tells me that the church that houses the gospel is made up of individuals with strengths and weaknesses. And made mistakes and had successes. But I also think at the same time, the better we understand this, the better we understand them and where it came from, and the better we understand the legacy of faith that we've inherited. But again, they're handing off the torch to us. Now we take the torch and we say, now we're going to take that legacy of faith, and what do we do going forward to the world around us? Vault of experience and knowledge and faith and sacrifice is something that we've now inherited, and we've got to do something with it. What will you do with what you've got? And that, I think that's the challenge. Let me just finish with this, and I'll be done. I remember years ago when I was in graduate school, we had a psychologist mentor of ours that was head of our department, and he was such a great guy. But went into the cafeteria one day, and he's sitting there and he's crying. And my buddy and I were kind of shocked by it. We sat down next to him, like, oh, what's going on, man? And he said, well, you guys don't know, but I served in Vietnam. And he says, I went through years of psychotherapy after Vietnam. And he said, I went to a movie last night that has just, it's still hitting me. And he says, it finally brought closure to me based on this movie. And I'm like, God, what movie did you go see? He says, it's called Platoon.
Oh, no.
And he says, it brought closure to me. I went, wow. Okay, so, but we ought to go tomorrow night. So my buddy and I went and saw Platoon that night, and through most of it I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is horrible. Okay, but the redemption for him came in the last few minutes of that movie, and it has some parallels here. The last scene, The guy is shot in his last, he's wounded in his last big firefight, and he climbs into the helicopter, And the helicopter is panning out, and you can see all the bodies lying that were part of the firefight. And where the, anyway, I won't go into detail about that, but it's a pretty gruesome scene, okay? And he's looking at it from the helicopter, and then you hear his voiceover, and he's saying, I knew at that moment how long I had served, and with my wound, that this was, the war was over for me. I was going to be going home. But he said, as it's lifting, I thought, as I'm looking out there, and I'll paraphrase basically what he said, it was left to those of us who survived to make something of our lives. For those of our friends who wouldn't come back. That our lives had to be good so that their sacrifices weren't in vain. Yeah. Well, again, to a certain extent, I think as we look at the struggle of the church to get to this point, and again, the legacy of faith that we have inherited says, what are we doing with our lives? What are we doing in terms of our responsibility to the world for those that were crossing the plains, those that went through what they went through, those that were killed and harmed at Far West, all of those kind of places. That's our story, guys. And what we do with it, I think, is on us. And so that's why I love church history, because it teaches me what I think I'm supposed to take forward. So anyway, I leave that with you in Jesus' name. Amen. And thank you for joining us for another Monday morning class. Hope you enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions about future topics that we could discuss, or if you had any questions concerning something that you heard in the class, please drop us a note. We'd love to hear from you. As always, if you happen to be in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, please come in and join us on a Monday morning. We'd love to see you and identify who you are. If the podcast itself is resonating with you, go ahead and click subscribe so that Apple can figure out where we are. We'd love to hear from you. So again, thank you for coming, and we'll see you for another Monday morning class.